You're listening to the Business for Good podcast, the show where you'll hear inspirational stories about companies making money by solving some of the world's most pressing problems. I'm your host, Paul Shapiro, and I'm glad you've joined us.
Hello, friend, and welcome to episode number 138 of the Business for Good podcast. I'm so glad that many folks are getting a lot out of our new Cultivated Meat series on this podcast. If you're just tuning in, this episode is the sixth in our multi-part podcast series on cultivated meat. The previous five episodes include the CEOs of Eat Just, Fork and Good, Mosa Meat, New Harvest, and Olive Farms, and we've still got more to come. I also appreciate all the feedback from readers and listeners about the new updated paperback edition of my book, Clean Meat, which just came out on April 9th, 2024. Like the 2018 edition, the paperback 2024 edition of Clean Meat still tells the inspirational stories of the entrepreneurs, the scientists, and the investors all racing to commercialize slaughter-free meat. But I've updated the paperback edition to include recent major debate and events in the still nascent industry, from nomenclature to regulatory approval to scaling challenges and more. I'm told it's a page-turner, and I'd be grateful if you ordered a copy and encouraged your social circle to do so as well. Now, while Blue Nalu isn't mentioned in the first edition of the book, this leader in the cultivated fish sector is included in the new edition. So while in 2018, Blue Nalu was barely a twinkle in anyone's imagination, today the company is one of the better funded ones in the cultivated meat space, having raised more than $100 million since its inception, including about $35 million toward the end of 2023, which is a notoriously difficult time to fundraise. Blue Nalu's founder and CEO, Lou Cooperhouse, is optimistic about their path to success. As you'll hear in this episode, Lou is not working to compete against the commodity meats like chicken, beef, and pork. Rather, he is pursuing a strategy to compete against products that are exponentially higher in cost, like bluefin tuna, which can often sell for more than $100 a pound. In this conversation, Lou lays out his vision for a future Blue Nalu factory with multiple 100,000-liter cultivators churning out some of the priciest oceanic delicacies out there. And because of this high price point, Lou thinks that his economic model is among the most attractive out there. We also talk about Blue Nalu's work in the Middle East and in Asia, where they may build their future factory, what Lou thinks the biggest barriers to success are, and more. I now bring you the CEO of Blue Nalu, my friend, Lou Cooperhouse. Lou, welcome back to the Business for Good podcast.
Well, thanks for having me back, Paul. It's great to be connected again.
You are the repeat here. There's only a few people who have the honor of repeating on Business for Good. So maybe if you come back, you're going to be like the Tom Brady of the Business for Good podcast.
But that's all good.
I remember when you were on last time, it was about 4 years ago, and I had gone down to San Diego. You were very generous and invited me to your facility for a tasting. And I had some of your delicious, I think it was yellowtail. Wasn't that what I ate then?
It was.
And you graciously asked me to make a few remarks before a crowd that had assembled of journalists and staff and supporters and so on. And I'll never forget your face. When I started, I said, I really enjoyed it, but I thought that there was something missing. And I could see in your face the look of fright and horror. And then I said, what was missing, it seemed to be, was the mercury and the antibiotics and other parts of fish. And I can see the relief come over you. So even now, that's a kind of a favorite memory of mine, of my existence in the cultivated meat space.
Very funny.
Yeah. No, that was good. So it's been 4 years since I've tried your product, but you've raised an enormity of money since then, including recently raising $35 million toward the end of 2023. So first of all, congratulations on raising capital at a time when it's very difficult for many companies in the cultivated meat space to raise capital.
No, thanks, Paul. Yeah, when you visited us 4 years ago, it was a very monumental occasion for the company. At that time, we were really proud to show that our product, Yellowtail Amberjack, was one of eight different finfish species that we worked on at the time. And it was our demonstration that the product really was something that presented all the functional attributes of its conventional counterpart. What that means to me as a food guy is the product could be prepared in its natural raw state. Somebody who wanted to have sushi, it could be prepared in a cooked state, meaning seared, sauteed, pan-fried, deep-fried, or an acidified state, if you will, like poke, kimchi, ceviche. And that was really, you know, kind of our proof of concept that we did in fact have a product that had all the same sensory, culinary, functional attributes. And it was real seafood, just made this new way. And as you said, absent of mercury or plastics or pollutants or what have you. So a very exciting day for Blenalu. And that was hard to believe 4 years ago. And as you now know, we focused on bluefin tuna Toro as our first commercial product, given its global consumer interest, lack of access, clearly not sustainable, also very high mercury at the highest level, in fact, beloved around the world. And when it's available, just not consistent. So we're excited to offer a product that really checks every single box, if you will. Truly a superior value proposition to the consumer, you know, mercury, plastics, toxins, pollutants, to the food service operator, consistent and accessible, 100% yield every single time. So it really is something that we're quite excited to bring to the market in the coming years.
Well, I'm eager to talk about that exactly, about when you think that is going to be coming to the market. But let me just ask a provocative question about that. So, you know, you founded the company in 2018. If you were projecting back then in 2018 when you started this, that if you fast forward to 2024, and as we speak today, there's no cultivated meat on the market. Eat Just, Upside, they're not selling anymore. Blenalu is not yet selling. There's not one company that is selling. Would you have been surprised to hear that? Like, were you more optimistic back then about the timeline for commercialization? Or would you have thought, no, that seems about right, that by 2024, we won't have anybody selling?
I have to say, Paul, it does seem about right. And I'll tell you why. Because as you know, I've been in the food industry. It's hard to believe. I know I look like I'm 20, but I've been in the industry for 40 years now. And, yes. and the first thing I always talk about for any entrepreneur is know what you don't know. And boy, was there a lot that we didn't know when this industry started. And you know well from being author of the best-selling Clean Meat, soon to be second edition.
Very kind of you. Thank you.
But
I'll say the Blenalu is in the updated paperback edition that is now out. So you'll be pleased to know that you can start signing your own books when people go to visit the Blenalu office. But sorry to interrupt you. So, all right, you were saying it's not that surprising to you that nothing's on the market yet.
No, and I'll tell you why, because I started the company. It was very challenging, unlike any food industry ever before it. You know, so what do I mean by that? Nobody ever propagated fish shells. So all the knowledge was, you know, existed on the terrestrial mammalian side. Propagating fish shells, creating stable cell lines. These species were absolutely unknown. We didn't know what would work, what didn't work. Obviously, we wanted to develop a food grade supply chain. Did not exist either. Scalability did not exist either. You know, the food industry is about high volume, historically very low profit. You know, it's not unlike the farm industry, which was low volume, high profit. So it's a total game changer in how one thinks about scalability. So again, a food grade supply chain, non-existent technology. Of course, we want to do it with an animal component free basis. The regulatory aspect was huge. So despite all the things that we might accomplish, no nation in the world, when I started the company, had any regulatory approval, let alone methodology in place. So we're excited to see how far we come there. And of course, no consumers ever heard about this. We didn't even know what nomenclature to use. So again, you have so many challenges, not to mention you're actually in an industry that's based on cultural, even biblical in nature, highly supported and in fact subsidized by governments around the world. So no shortage of challenges. So look how far we've come in the last 6 years. In our case, we're very proud. We have literally hundreds of stable cell lines across 8 different finfish species with an animal component-free media that we've developed. Patents in process, you know, are fairly down the pathway there. A food grade supply chain established. We're so excited to see regulatory approval now in 3 nations with Singapore, Israel, most recently, and of course, America. More to come. Wow, look how far we have come in just 6 years from so many challenges. Consumer education is even becoming, you know, much more familiar. So we're excited to support in Asia. You know, so we come from an industry where there's no knowledge whatsoever and no intelligence from the consumer to one that's really on the, you know, really on the leading edge of commercialization. So a long, long way in 6 years and just given so many constraints that we had, you know, not that long ago. So for all the entrepreneurs in the space, you know, we've really overcome a great deal. Yes, there's more work to be done, no question about it, but so many of the fundamental technology challenges are now being solved, you know, and scalability is obviously next in line here, but without regulatory approval, without a food grade supply chain, without some core technologies and animal component free media, you know, we would never have a market, but those things have not been solved. So what's left is big, but it's certainly, we've overcome so much already.
All right. So you're talking about regulatory approval as if it's already a given, but only a couple companies in the United States have received it. If you were to get regulatory approval to start selling, and I'm presuming you only need FDA because this is fish, right? You don't need USDA approval, right? So unlike some of these other companies that are doing terrestrial animals, you will only need FDA approval. So if you were to get that today, reportedly, you guys are producing hundreds of pounds of product a week at your pilot plant in San Diego. Would that then go into commercialization? Like, would you be selling hundreds of pounds of your fish as soon as you started, after you got the approval?
We're not approving that level of volume, Paul, today, but obviously we have that wherewithal, you know, in the coming months. You know, it all depends on, you know, some manufacturing scale up that we plan to do. But, you know, candidly, our goal is not to be a manufacturer, and we do not want to be in commerce in any meaningful way until we have the capacity to really provide it. So we are not we plan to, you know, when we have regulatory approval, yes, we plan to do some market introductions, some limited time offers, LTOs as they're called. But we want to do that to really get some feedback. We're not here to pretend we're in commerce in a single restaurant, you know, with a small amount of volume. We really want to wait till our whole goal of Blinala has always been slow and steady, if you will, wins the race. We're not here to, we want to get regulatory approval on a scalable process, and we are doing that. We are getting regulatory approval that will really enable us to get consumer feedback, to learn about product positioning and placement. We're launching with sushi and premium fine dining restaurants. We're introducing something that hasn't even been available in this way before. It's consistent every time. It could be an appetizer, an entree. We actually have a lot of interest from fine dining, catering, hotels, sushi establishments, Michelin starred establishments. So just a lot of inbound interest here. And we're really trying to understand how much volume there could be. Our goal, frankly, is to get offtake agreements as a result of this consumer validation that we plan to do during the coming year. So again, it's really not to launch into commerce and then really not be able to come back with any kind of volume for a couple of years. So we really want to do any kind of commerce we do is purely for educational purposes, market feedback, consumer validation, and frankly, to obtain offtake agreements on volume. So our goal is, if you will, like the produce sector, you know, before people plant farms, they typically have a contract in place, and we similarly plan to do the same thing. We want to build our factory with contracts in place. We think it's very, very doable given the amount of market interest we've had in our products thus far.
Okay. Well, that's exciting. So let's dive right into that then, because reportedly you're seeking to build a 140,000 square foot facility. You want to have 8 100,000 liter bioreactors. Are those reports accurate?
That's correct. Yeah, we actually did a techno-economic analysis a couple of years ago. We've actually done it three times. Even in 2018, we did our first one. So I think that's really a very relevant story, Paul. I mean, Blinala was really founded based on how do we get to volume? You know, what does volume look like? So even in 2018, in year one of the company, we actually designed our first factory just to kind of understand, you know, and really help the whole team. And one of the things I, you know, really want to talk to you about today is about how critical the team is in any company. It certainly has been so valuable for us. It's thinking about large scale production from day one. Everything we're doing, the technologies that we're applying to enable global consumer adoption, to enable scalability, to really have a food grade supply chain and quality infrastructure in place as early as possible, are all about large scale production. So yeah, we did this analysis in 2018. We did it again in 2020. We did it again in 2022. And each time, and to your point, so we did talk about 100,000 liter bioreactors generating about 6 million pounds of 100% yielded bluefin tuna Toro in our first large scale factory that can be quite profitable. And you're correct, and about the size, about the footprint that you've described there. So that is what we're calling Blinala One, our first large scale factory.
Nice.
That we're working towards.
So, it, you know, in an earlier interview in this series, Josh Tetrick from Good Meat said that he needs to get the cost for his factories down to less than $200 million for it to make economic sense for him. You've now done three analyses on what you think it might cost to do a Blue Nalu 1. What price point do you want to get to in order to be able to produce those 6 million pounds of bluefin?
So I think the way to actually ask that question, Paul, depends on the product that one is producing. So obviously other companies, including some you've interviewed, are working on, if you will, more commodity products that command a lower value.
Right. They're trying to sell chicken at a couple dollars a pound, right? You're going to be selling at some multiple of that, right?
That's exactly the point. So we obviously have our CapEx situation. We all have the same CapEx, you know, challenge to actually create substantial food volume in a reasonably capitalized factory here that might look, you know, might seem more like an aseptic processing facility for, you know, aseptic juices or what have you. Very expensive equipment, no doubt. But I think what really unique about Blue Nalu and our whole focus from day one, if you will, is about value, not volume. And really, you know, this is the classic economies of scale situation. So we're focusing on high value finfish species. Bluefin tuna is our first one. And the Toro, which is the belly fat portion, if you will, it's the Wagyu beef of the sea, is our first product that we're going to market with. We can be at price parity and be very profitable in our first factory, even at a facility cost of $200 million to $300 million.
Okay.
Well, and you know, that's the difference here. Yes, the CapEx is a big deal, but it's far less of a big deal when you're going after price parity for a conventional price point that is significantly, you know, literally 10x or 20x of what you might get for a commodity chicken or seafood product.
Yeah. So let me ask that, you know, if you look at bluefin tuna prices, it ranges dramatically from like $20 a pound to $200 a pound, depending on where it's from, what part of the body and so on. So are you targeting more like the $20 a pound or the $200 a pound price range when you're talking about this? Because if you're saying it's 10 times more, it sounds more like the, you know, the $20 a pound. But if it's all the way up to $200 a pound, is that what you're thinking?
We're actually going to find out, Paul, what that price parity is. But, you know, we're actually have learned from, we've done 85 different interviews to date. We're doing quite a bit more this year with leading food service operators. We've also interviewed over 6,000 consumers as well. Both the customer and the consumer have been an area of great focus. We learned from sushi operators that, you're right, bluefin tuna can range quite dramatically in price throughout the year. What's absolutely loved is the Toro that only could be found from the bluefin tuna, whereas Akami or some of the leaner cuts can be found from other species and other tuna species, I should say. So to answer your question, it's typically north of 60 or 70 bucks a pound, you know, and can be 100, 120 bucks a pound. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a pretty wide range in that 60 to 120 range of what's typically the price point for bluefin tuna Toro. Realize that bluefin tuna Toro as a component is typically not even found today. You know, typically, if I'm a sushi operator in Japan or Korea, what have you, I'm going to market, I'm bringing in a carcass of a bluefin tuna, and I'm filleting that in the back with, you know, yield that my goal is obviously to use the entire fish, but I have a Akami, Chutoro, Otoro, cheek, you know, other parts of the body. But those who are very familiar with what the value is and how they actually price it on the menu have told us that ranges between, you know, 60 to 120 bucks a pound. And that price point is expected to increase dramatically in the years ahead.
Yeah. You can see
what's available.
Yeah. So you can see how the IRR or the internal rate of return is actually pretty good on that. If you are selling at $100 a pound, I'm just doing quick math in my head, but if it's at that upper range of $300 million in CapEx to build the facility, you're selling at at $100 a pound. So you got to sell 3 million pounds to get at least the revenue, not actually, yeah, you know, be in the clear, it's, but it's, have the revenue.
Exactly. 6 million pounds at $100 a pound is very obviously $600 million gross revenue in a factory that might cost $200 to $300 million.
So, yeah, and if you have a margin of 70% has been reported as your target, you can see the IRR is actually extremely attractive, yes, presuming all of those numbers line up. Yeah, that's cool. Well, I hope that I'll get a slice for free and not pay $100 a pound, but I would pay $100 a pound to try it, I think, but still, So let's talk about where this factory is going to be. You've signed an MOU and taken some investment from the Saudi government to build your plant there. But I see you also have a partnership with Thai Union, the major seafood company based in Thailand. Awa Farms, whose CEO Didier Tubia is also on this series and talked about how he's going to build a pilot plant in Thailand. Are you planning on building this factory in Saudi Arabia and Thailand? Where are you thinking that you're going to actually break ground when you do this?
Now, what was reported, Paul, is we have an MOU with NEOM in Saudi Arabia, but it's not to build a factory there. It's actually to work with them on a collaboration basis to help them establish the infrastructure for capacity, for regulatory approval, for market development, intelligence, and so forth. But not, it's no commitment to build a factory there, nor is there one to build in Thailand or anywhere else. So we haven't made that decision yet, Paul. So we do have a lot of partners, as you know, around the globe. Our focus, however, is very heavily in Asia, where I think your listeners probably know this, but I'll say it anyway, but per capita consumption of seafood is somewhere between 3 to 5x what it is in America and also in Europe. People love seafood in Asia. People love bluefin. In fact, that's where it's all sold, is Japan and Korea. So our target market is Japan and Korea, but also Singapore, Thailand, and the balance of Asia is certainly something that's very, very attractive to us. So we do see one of the first factories clearly being built in Asia. What nation? Not sure. The first one may, in fact, be built in the U.S. Location, also not sure. But again, it's premature at this point. But we're just really trying to, again, part of our market research is really trying to establish where these offtake agreements will be and where we want to build that first factory. And frankly, where the best incentives will come in to construct that, because we're confident, but we need to see it, that there will be some, you know, non-dilutive financing, joint ventures that will make that decision for that first factory come alive during the next 24 months or so.
Nice. Yeah, I was actually in Thailand not that long ago, and I was really shocked that not only is seafood consumption dramatically higher than it is in the US. I knew it was higher, but I didn't realize it was multiples higher. But that on a per pound basis, per capita, the Thai people eat more aquatic animals than land animals on a per pound basis.
Yep.
They eat very little beef. They eat, you know, good amount of chicken, but they eat more aquatic animal meat than terrestrial animal meat. Whereas, you know, you look in the US, it's like we're eating like 220 pounds of terrestrial animal meat per year. And then, you know, maybe like 10 or 15 pounds of aquatic animal meat. Whereas when you're looking at Thailand, it's actually more aquatic than land. So, you know, it's really a stunning thing for somebody who has led a US-centric life to see those numbers. So I think, you know, the product is definitely needed anywhere, but maybe more needed in Asia than here.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So is the biggest barrier for you the capital right now, Lou? Like, is the problem that you still need to make new inventions in order to bring the cost down, or in order to actually scale up and build bioreactors that have never existed before? Or is it capital? Like, if somebody offered you all the capital you needed right now, would you still have to innovate? Would there still be new inventions needed to scale? Or are you ready to scale today?
The barrier, Paul, is just time. So I think, you know, it is time and capital. But, you know, when I say time, we have, because of our TEA, our technical economic analysis, we recognize, you know, the pathway to commercialization is about time. It's actually demonstrating and transferring technologies that we've already established. So the good news is we already had the fundamental technology established. Now we are doing a tech transfer, not needing to reinvent technology at all. So the tech transfer is from, you know, through the route from 250 to 2,000 to 20,000 and perhaps beyond to 100,000, as you've described. You know, that is our goal, is to, you know, work our way up to 100,000 over, again, it's about time. Each technology transfer, you know, can take 6-9 months. But again, the next couple of years, we plan to validate at 20,000 and 100,000 liter. So that's really our goal here, is to see how far we can go. So we're building a factory based on already validated process at that scale, meeting the metrics that we've established at TEA, not just at the bench or the 250 liter, but the 20,000 and beyond, you know, whatever that final endpoint is.
The way that you're speaking already offers the answer to this question, but I just want to ask it just to make sure. There's nothing that you've learned in the last 6 years of running this company that makes you think that this isn't feasible, right? Like, if you look at these obituaries that are being written about this industry, they're essentially alleging that this is just not actually possible to scale. Not that it's not a good idea, But the critics, in this brand of critic at least, is saying this is not even possible to do. I presume you vociferously disagree with that based on what you're saying.
Oh, it's beyond possible. It's clearly possible. It will happen, Paul. I think what, to me, the way I interpret what the any criticism is, it's just going to be challenging at some of the lower value products. So, you know, I think the real question is that has not been really brought, you know, by the media is, you know, I think it might have been said early on that this will displace a, you know, significant amount of American agriculture, farming. You know, is this a category for ground beef? Is this a category for chicken nuggets? Is this a category for fish sticks? Or is this a category for steaks, you know, and higher value products, like in our case, bluefin tuna? So there's so many seafood products that was very attractive to me, frankly. I started coming and said, wow, this is going to be very challenging with all the hurdles I talked about before. But I said, it's even more challenging to work on lower value products. And the beauty of seafood is not only does it have challenges for human health, obviously animal welfare, but also has issues with lack of consistency and lack of access. These are things that were unique to seafood versus meat and poultry. But also it happens to overlay very nicely with price point. Yeah. So I was just, you know, as a food guy, I was just really attracted to fabulous technology, absolutely scalable, very confident from day one. But in order to be economically feasible and to have a unique value proposition, one needed to really, you know, leverage that technology for a product category and area of focus that makes sense, where you can really provide a superior value. The food industry, you know, foods in general, just the technology. I've been involved with food tech my whole career. People don't eat technology. They eat something that's delicious, that really has a superior benefit or really resonates in some way. So our whole goal at Blinalo is to really create products that clearly do differentiate, they resonate, they're arguably superior from their conventional counterpart, superior in the context, again, of consistency every time. I know how inconsistency is a fatal flaw of conventional seafood. Wild capture fisheries in particular, you are what you eat, right? So, you know, fish is so dramatically different from one part of the world to the other, one season to another. So the consistency and the lousy yield and the huge environmental footprint and the lack of sustainability really are big issues with food service. And human health, we've actually learned, Paul, you mentioned how people love seafood, particularly in Asia. We actually have done, as I mentioned, several thousand interviews, consumer intercepts. We asked people, well, these are people that are frequent sushi eaters. So they're pre-vetted to be a frequent consumer. And we say, well, why do you love seafood? Why do you love sushi so much? And they've responded to us, well, because of the health benefits. We're moving away from red meat towards seafood. High omegas, et cetera, et cetera. And then we actually kind of probe further. Well, if I may ask, well, why don't you consume even more seafood? And they say, well, it may have some health issues. But you just said it had health benefits. And they said, I know. So then we say, well, what do you mean? Why health challenges? Well, I read about microplastics in the ocean. I'm not even sure what that means, if it might get into my fish. I've read about nuclear radiation. I've read about, you know, mercury, you know, for when my wife or myself or my mother, what have you, was pregnant or nursing. Now there's young children that there is actually some warning about minimizing your intake of sushi up to age 11, because now kids are having sushi. So people are feeling conflicted, you know, at the consumer level. So again, it's unique to seafood versus meat and poultry. And all these things I kind of hypothesize would be true. We've now validated that, along with the food service challenges. So again, frankly, the higher price points makes this a very attractive category. So again, I think in the whole category of cultivated meats, it's really, you know, being very selective about, yes, as economies of scale happen, all of us will benefit. You know, the rising tide will lift all boats here. But for us, you know, beginning with high value products and beginning at price parity even is something that's very, very, very feasible without, you know, and really demonstrating a superior product. I give you people another choice.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness to those who are pursuing, you know, chicken, pork, and beef, you would hope that, and I bet, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I presume they would say, you know, if you look at the trajectory of every technology, it starts out very expensive and it becomes much cheaper. And so you think about electric cars and how expensive they once were, and now more and more people are having them. And now with BYD in China, you get even cheaper electric cars. And so maybe somebody will figure out how to get down to price parity with ground beef, let's say, or maybe even chicken. We'll see. But
and they will. It just takes time.
Right. Yeah. So speaking of time, you know, you've been doing this for 6 years now. You started the company again in 2018. You've raised over $100 million. Surely there is an immense amount that you've learned in those 6 years about what works and what doesn't work. Is there anything today that you would go back and you'd tell the Lou of 2018? So if you're 20 years old now, and then I guess you would be, you know, a tween at this point 6 years ago, right? So, you know, the 14-year-old Lou who started this company, you know, is there anything that you would tell him to do differently than what actually happened? You know, you look back and think, I wish that we would have done this or that, or not done this in these past 6 years.
I nothing comes to mind, Paul, to be honest. I think what we've obviously all learned is the economic headwinds, you know, and now even some government political headwinds are upon us as well. And that's really why, you know, in the beef or poultry category in particular with cattlemen is a very challenging sector, you know, and I was very, you know, I'll use the word proactive in that, you know, we were all about working as an and, not an or. Our whole focus at Blue Nalu from day one was we were working with industry. We have strategic investors that come from industry. And as a person who, as you know, last time you profiled me, we talked about chicken nuggets. So I worked at Conagra in my earlier days, back in my 20s. I was a group leader for processed meats for North America. I was a chicken nugget and a hamburger guy, actually. So I know about high volume and how the throughput of that equipment of those large factories is quite significant, but also how prominent, how strong the American agricultural sector really is. So, you know, Blue Nalu, I just got started. And frankly, there were some challenges that came from the plant-based category before us and some of the labeling with milk and so forth that preceded that, you know, that really made me very conscious of, listen, this is all about working with industry. And as you may know, Paul, but we actually became recently a member of the National Fisheries Institute. So NFI. So we are now seen as not wild or farm, but cell cultured. We are now a third form of seafood. And for us, that's just huge recognition for what we've been about from day one. And I think the whole industry, our cultivated industry, I'm really proud of, has become about and, not or. You know, and I think that's really something that I was an early advocate for, but I'm really excited to see that all of our peers in this industry are all about, you know, we have the North American Meat Institute working in partnership with our industry, you know, and thanks to Upside Foods leadership, and really addressing some of the political headwinds that this industry is facing, coming from the ag and cattle sector in particular. And obviously, in our case, we have the NFI working in partnership with us and collaborating with us. You know, we're just addressing this that, you know, the meat, poultry, and seafood industry needs this industry to succeed. There will not be enough, you know, protein to feed this planet in the decades ahead. And we're excited by the amount of strategic investors that this category is really attracting, that really recognize the same thing. This is about feeding the world and future generations and not thinking about today and winning political races, but really and stifling innovation, but in fact, giving consumers a choice that frankly has superior benefits to some or another option for others, or they don't have to have it at all. So we're just trying to give like America was built on, you know, choice and freedom.
Indeed, indeed. So there's nothing that you would necessarily have done differently, but during those 6 years, maybe you've learned some things and had some resources that were made available to you that have benefited you. You have a very different background than many of the founders of the companies in this space. As you mentioned, you know, your background was making chicken nuggets for Conagra and other food products, right? So, which is very different from somebody, let's say, like Uma Valetti, who was a cardiologist, or Josh Tetrick, who, you know, was a lawyer. And you just have a very different background as a food industry person. So are there resources that you have found useful in your career in the food industry, or maybe even during your time as CEO of Blue Nalu, that you would recommend to others who are thinking about trying to make a difference in the world also, like any books, speeches, anything else that you would find compelling that you'd recommend?
No, definitely, Paul. I think, first of all, just as a, you're right, in my career in the food industry, it's all been about food innovation, tech commercialization. I was involved with medical nutrition, fresh cut produce, perishable foods, sous vide, high pressure processing, cook chill, all kinds of technologies. And what I learned through that, it's about, again, that superior value proposition. So my first thing I would recommend anybody, at the end of the day, it's about culinary. It's about taste. You know, it's really giving consumers an experience, something superior, something that really does offer benefits. And I think one of the things that we're learning, and that all of us are learning in this industry, is what are those benefits that most resonate? Do people actually pay for a product, you know, a cultivated meat, poultry, or seafood for, because it's sustainable, it's ethical, no animals are killed or harmed, or is it because it's healthier or humane, it's consistent, you know, it's kosher or halal? What are the attributes that really resonate? And it's different for all of us. So it's really, I guess my first learning is, excuse me, it's all about culinary and really, you know, taste being very forward. But in terms of books, you know, that actually have influenced me, there's actually a couple. So, you know, one is, as you know, I've also been very involved with innovation. I used to run the Rutgers Food Innovation Center. I'm still the chairman of their advisory board. So I've worked with so many entrepreneurs. And a couple of books I recommended to folks, you know, one is Marcus Buckingham's First Break All the Rules. And it's really where he interviewed 80,000 managers at 400 companies. And he really talked about the team. And it's really about, you know, and a second book, I just want to, you know, I'll talk about both at the same time, is Great by Choice, you know, by Jim Collins. And he also authored Good to Great. But Great by Choice is an interesting one. They're both about discipline, preparation, thoughtfulness, hiring the right people, really engaging in some of the core values and, you know, interfunctional relationships, accountability, you know, just really that success doesn't happen overnight, you know, and it's really about a thoughtful process that's really so driven by discipline. You know, one thing that we did at Blunalo is early on, you know, and we've actually put this into motion, is really establishing core values. And I'd love to talk about our core values, but number one, you know, four of them. But the first one we call being epicurious, you know, being inquisitive, thinking outside the box, being flexible, being a listener, you know, and it really kind of reflects some of these two books I mentioned, Great by Choice and First Break All the Rules. Second one is being bold. You know, it's really about, you know, accountability, action oriented, strategic. Number three is being a lighthouse. So again, a seafood term here, but one about, you know, really representing best practices, you know, really demonstrating integrity, humility, seeking continuous improvement, prioritizing safety and quality. And number four is being true blue. So true blue is, you know, being respectful of each other internally and externally, supportive, engaged, collaborative, creating trust, you know, really working as a team. So I think part of, you know, any message to any of your future entrepreneurs or current ones is really developing, embracing, activating core values that really create the chemistry, the connectivity amongst the team. I'm also a huge fan. My whole career has been about open innovation. That means all ideas are not created here. You know, we got to really, you know, we're doing things that have never been done before. So in thinking about that, it's establishing a scientific advisory board or a corporate advisory board, you know, or just really working with partners around the planet. You know, who are the folks could help us to scale up supply chain, operations, market intelligence, regulatory intelligence, and so on and so forth. Just really, again, I think that's, you know, those books kind of correspond with kind of, you know, how, you know, Blunalo, frankly, I think all of us are somewhat lean. We have so much to do. And how do you establish, when you have so many obstacles and challenges and opportunities in front of you, how do you establish that with a very lean team so you can be very conservative with your investors' cash? So that's really been how we've been set up from the beginning. It makes a lot of long days, but we just really have, first and foremost, just an amazing team of Blunalo. And I think all of us, you know, in this industry really have done a great job overcoming so many challenges. And again, the future is very bright, you know, and I think it's just a matter of time. And again, more capital that will be required, but we will absolutely be successful. It's just a matter of a short amount of time now. So the last 6 years have been great. And the next six, you will see factories being built around the world for sure.
I'm excited. So apparently you intend to break ground in 2026. And it's like an 18-month process. So like in 2027 or 2028, perhaps, we'll see the first commercial Blue Nalu $100 per pound Toro coming off of the line. And I'll get a free sample of it. I'm looking forward to that. But that'll be very exciting. And I hope that we'll be talking about that when that factory, when the ribbon cutting occurs. So finally, you were mentioning for, you know, either entrepreneurs or wantrepreneurs who are listening right now that these are resources that might be useful for them. Is there anything you'd recommend that they do if they're thinking, I really want to make a difference, but I'm not sure what to do? Are there ideas for companies that don't exist or that maybe aren't yet being done well enough that you would recommend that somebody else take up the mantle and say, I'm going to go do that?
Yeah, that's a big task, Paul, especially given today's environment, you know, but obviously, you know, conversely, I think, you know, there's so many amazing companies that are in this category in precision fermentation and plant-based and cell culture. Clearly any wannabe entrepreneurs, you know, certainly should think about joining these companies. We're all hiring. We're all looking for talent. And I think that the opportunity is really bright here. So, you know, it's exciting to see, you know, colleges, universities, you know, really having more programs, more focus in this category, more interest in sustainability and food tech in this whole new category here. So yeah, I mean, they're obviously, to be an entrepreneur is challenging. It's not for everybody, not for the faint of heart for sure. But certainly to get experience working at a company is a great first step, is what I really would recommend.
Okay, fair enough. So basically, Lou says, don't start your own company just yet. Join Blue Nalu or one of the other companies that's raised some capital and is hiring. And I love the quote from Ben Horowitz, the co-founder of Andreessen Horowitz, the venture capital fund, in his book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things. He says that when you start your own company, you will sleep like a baby because you will wake up every 2 hours and cry. Exactly. And you know, there are some days where that is more resonant than others. But Lou, it's wonderful to talk with you, and it's inspirational to hear your story and all that you are seeking to accomplish. So as you know, I'm rooting hard for you, and I hope to be at that ribbon cutting when the new factory and Asia or wherever it's going to be is finally built. And
you'll be there, Paul, for sure.
I'll make sure that you pre-approve any comments that I might make before that happens. So
sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Lou.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for listening. I hope you found it useful. And if you did, please let the world know. Leave the show a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast app and share the episode with your friends. Who knows? Maybe you'll inspire one of them to be in the business of doing good themselves.